So, the other day at on Saint-Hubert in Saint-Denis, where we had a deployment, I met a young lady from Quebec, and I asked her, she was speaking French, so I asked her, do you know why we have those crazy politicians? Don't you think that the population is making a mistake? And she says, well, yeah, but most of the people that vote usually speaks English. Well, actually, see, I'm going to show you, like, I'm going to have a kind of an introduction of what the Treaty of Westphalia really means. So I'm going to. So if you see a little red light here, so there might be some French-speaking terrorists here that would like to annihilate me. Right, because I want to read this. I think it's going to be a good introduction in terms of understanding what this Treaty of Westphalia really means for today. Also what it means in terms of understanding the whole dynamic in which we're in, a dynamic which starts pretty early. We're not talking about just the last 30 years, but a few hundred of years ago. It's not too long. There's a few different parts which are really important. And yeah, by the way, this book is from François Rabelais. It's a book called Gargantua. And in this book, there is a war. There's a war which is being started by a bunch of idiots, a bunch of evil advisors that basically advise a quite limited king that starts a war against Grand Gousier, who's Gargantua's father. And but Gargantua is the one leading the fight, and you know they kick their ass pretty good. But at the end, there's a speech that Gargantua gives. It's called Gargantua's Address to the Vanquished. So he's talking about the ones that he beat up. Our fathers, grandfathers, and ancestors from time immemorial have been of such nature and disposition that as memorial to the victories and triumph they have won in the battles they have fought, they have preferred to erect monuments in the hearts of the vanquished by a display of clemency than to raise trophies in the form of architecture in the lands they have conquered. For they have valued the lively gratitude of men won by their liberality more highly than mute inscriptions on arcs, columns, and pyramids, which are subjects to the injuries of climate and all men's spite. You may very well remember the clemency they showed towards the Bretons on the day of Saint-Aubin du Cormier and at the dismantling of Parthenay. You've heard, and as you heard, admired, of the generous treatment they extended to the barbarians of Spagnola, who had pillaged, depopulated, and sacked the maritime borders of Olonne and Talmondé. This whole hemisphere has resounded with praise and congratulation extended by yourselves and your fathers when Alfarbal, king of Canaria, not satisfied with his own fortune, made a furious assault upon the land of Onyx, practicing piracy among all the Armorican islands and down the neighboring coasts. He was taken and defeated in fair naval battle by my father, God preserve and protect him. But what did you see? Whereas other kings and emperors, even such as call themselves Catholic, would have miserably ill-treated him, harshly imprisoned him, and asked a prohibitive ransom for him, my father treated him courteously and kindly, lodged him near to himself in his own palace, and with incredible generosity sent him back under safe conduct, loaded with gifts, loaded with favors, loaded with every evidence of friendship. And what was the result? When he got back to his country, he summoned all the princes and estates of his kingdom, explained to them the humanity he had met within us, desiring them to deliberate on this, and consider how to show the world an example of gracious honor before we had shown graciousness. Whereupon it was unanimously decreed that to us of their entire lands, dominions, and kingdom, to be disposed of according to our discretion. So Alfarbal immediately returned in person with 9,038 large ships of freight, bearing the treasures not only of his house and the royal line, but almost his entire country. For as he was embarking to set sail with the west-northeast wind, everyone in the crowd threw on board gold, silver, rings, jewels, spices, drugs, and aromatic perfumes, parrots, pelicans, apes, civet cats, spotted weasels, and porcupines. If anyone did not throw in anything, rate that he possessed, he was accounted no good mother's son. When Al-Farbal arrived, he wished to kiss my aforesaid father's feet, but his sack was considered unworthy and was not permitted. So they exchanged the embrace of allies. The king then offered his presents, which were not accepted, being excessive by far. Then he yielded himself voluntarily as servant and vassal, himself and his posterity, and this gesture was not accepted since it did not seem an equitable one. By virtue of his estate's decree, he then surrendered his lands and kingdoms, proffering the title and conveyance, signed, sealed, and ratified by all those whose concern it was. But this was refused outright and the documents thrown in the fire. The end of it was that my said father began pitifully to lament and to weep copious tears when he considered the frank generosity and the simplicity of the Canarians. Carefully choosing his words, he made a speech conceived to minimize the favor he had shown them, saying that the good turn he had done them was not worth a button, that if he had treated them with any kindness, this was no more than he was by duty bound to do. But Al-Farbal only insisted the harder. What then was the outcome? Whereas for his ransom, levied at the highest rate, who might by some exercise of tyranny have exacted 2,000,000 crowns and kept his eldest children as hostages, they had voluntarily made themselves perpetual tributaries and undertaken to deliver to us each year 2,000,000 crowns of 24 karat gold. These were paid to us here in the first year, and the second they paid of their own free will 2,300,000 crowns, and the third 2,600,000, and the fourth 3,000,000, and each year they so increased their payment out of sheer goodwill that we shall soon be compelled to forbid their bringing us any more. Such is the nature of gratitude. Time, which gnaws and fritters all things away, only augments and increases the value of benefits. For one good turn freely done to an intelligent man grows continuously by his generous thoughts and remembrance. Being unwilling, therefore, in any way to fall short of the hereditary graciousness of my parents, I now absolve and deliver you, and make you as free and independent as before. Moreover, as you go out through the gate, every one of you shall be given 3 months' pay, so that you may return to your homes and families, and you shall be safely escorted by 600 men-at-arms and 8,000 foot under the command of my squire Alexander, so that you shall not be molested by the peasants. God be with you. I am sorry with all my heart that Picrocole is not here. Picrocole was the king that was invading Grand Gousier. For I would have given him to understand that this war was not waged at my wish or in the hope of augmenting my possessions or fame. But since he is lost, and no one knows how or where he has vanished, it is my desire that his kingdom shall devolve in its entirety on his son. And because he is too young, being not yet 5 years old, he shall be guided and instructed by the ancient princes and learned men of the kingdom. And inasmuch as a kingdom thus desolate would easily be ruined, were not some check put on the covetousness and avarice of its administrators, I ordain and will that Ponocrates, one of the friends of Gargantua, shall be supervisor over all his governors with all requisite authority, and that he attend constantly to the child until he finds him fit and able to act and rule for himself. I hold that a too feeble and spineless readiness to pardon malefactors is the cause of their likely doing wrong again, in the pernicious expectation of being pardoned. I bear in mind that Moses, the meekest man that was in his time on earth, sharply punished the mutineers and rebels among the children of Israel. I remember also that Julius Caesar, who was so gracious a commander that, according to Cicero, the ability to save and pardon every man was to him the height of good fortune, and the will to do so something to be counted among his supreme virtues. Nevertheless, in certain instances, rigorously punished the promoters of rebellion. Following these examples, I desire you to give up to me before you depart. First, that swaggering fellow Marquet, who by his vain presumption has been the origin and fomenter of this war. Secondly, his companions, the cake bakers, who neglected to correct his headstrong folly. And lastly, all Picrocole advisors, officers and servants who have incited, encouraged, or counseled him to cross his frontier for the purpose of troubling us. Okay. So, again, people get a bit of a
sense that, you know, you actually won the war. See, there are some differences between this and
what I'm going to go through is that if you win a war,
there are many options. You can get, as you said, right? You can put your own statues all over the place, or you can say, well, right, let's try to erect a monument in the hearts of the vanquished. And the funny thing with that, because Westphalia is a very, this street of Westphalia has certain resemblance to that. But this book was written in 1534. Mm-hmm. Treaty of Westphalia is 1644. 1534. Right? So, and LaRouche mentioned that many times recently around the war in the Middle East, that we are in a situation where people will accept ideas that were there, but they're going to accept it because we're in a time that these ideas were made to come, right? So we're in one of those times today where, as Matt mentioned pretty thoroughly, we have some of those people that could be considered as evil, but will actually do good. And if you're in a war, and by the way, the Treaty of Westphalia wasn't signed. Sometimes people have this idea that okay, let's stop the war, let's gather, let's have a treaty, and then it's going to be over. Now, while the people are discussing about how to bring peace, there is ongoing war, right? Unlike what we just read, right? If you just win, if the war is over, and you have, you know, it's because in the Treaty of Westphalia, you're talking about a whole. Maybe you can put the map of Europe at the time. And if you
can, you put that up. How do you do it? I don't know if it's on standby.
That's good.
Well, while you.
Just on standby.
While you push the right button.
Sorry. Absolute.
Because you see, the idea is that if you have an ongoing war among two people, it's a lot easier in a sense to deal when we have about 15 people. And also, it's being called the 30 Years' War. Some people put it a lot before that, like maybe 118. Some numbers like
like 100 years even before that, we had this disease of war already being spread, religious war. So the question is, how do you trigger one of those principles? Because yes, there are people that are getting at a point where they have to change. So how do they change? Yeah. How do we make sure it doesn't get worse? And at the time, you see, because what we have to understand here is that this map is a big mess, right? Or you have places in Germany where what you have actually is you have basically a prince for regions that are like as big as a city. There's no real union that is there in terms of founding a nation, but there is an empire, right? Because at the time you have a guy named Ferdinand II, who is the Holy Roman Emperor, basically running the whole show, being controlled, right? Same thing as with George Bush. There's no like sovereign thinking from these people. But you're in a situation that was basically under attack since probably 700 or 800 after Jesus Christ, where you have the development by the Venetians, right? Same bankers that today are represented by the Anglo-Dutch liberal system of economics. People that have, as you'll see, they have a pretty good way to get into a lot of affairs, and you can. I mean, it's you know, when people make fun of 007, right? Well, imagine like gazillions of those, and they just pick up information and they get whatever they can get to control. And what was developed around 700, 800 was this question of, there was a scam being, promoted called the donation of Constantine.
The donation of what?
Constantine.
Oh.
And which allowed the Pope, which at the time was, Gregory the Seventh, to basically, this donation was basically giving an enormous power to the Pope. And the funny thing is that Gregory the Seventh, 2 days before he became the Pope, was not even a priest.
Was he Catholic? Yeah, the Pope is Catholic. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm Catholic. Sorry. He became a priest the day before. But then he became the Pope, and we're still digging out some stuff about that, how... You see, a lot of people will say, oh, this was Catholic against Protestant, and at the time people would say, around that time people would say it was Catholic against the Muslims. Well, actually, Gregory the Seventh was just at war against anything. The Orthodox, Catholics. Because he was not there to represent Christianity, he was there to represent the Venetian interest. Because if you control the economy of these places, basically you control the currency, you control who, you know who's in power, if you own them, basically, you can do whatever you want. And in 700, also the thing with those ultramontanes is that the people being elected bishop or priest are not necessarily religious people. They're people from the military, people from the nobility, right? So, okay, you're a priest, there you go. Okay. But... So you have this enormous push with the use of the donation of Constantine, because before you had an example, I'm not going to go through much of that, but it's pretty vague, but you had with Charlemagne, and also people from the, a lot of Jewish, it's called the, I think it was the Radonite Jews, or a group of merchants, and people from, of course, the Muslim community. Do you remember the name of the Sultan? Awud? Al-Arun? Al-Arun. Okay. Where you had a certain type of development around this idea of a nation state, which was broken starting with this donation of Constantine, and the continuous spread of war. And that's what's happening. The problem is that in 1639, if I'm making a big jump, but in 1639 you have Ferdinand II, who's a big leader, the Holy Roman Emperor, who's unfortunately a fundy, and who recently went into a revolt against the Netherlands, and who managed with that to the Venetians managed to kind of foster his religious hatred. So you have a leader that's basically pushing for war, pushing for this idea of, as Rabelais attacks, it's not about taking lands or putting your statues all over the place. But that's what this guy is doing right now, he was doing. And you have a different break of a treaty. Because that's the other thing we should show, because when you're in the idea that might is right, and you have a treaty that doesn't say, okay, I'm going to care for you now. It says, let's not punch each other with a 2x4. Let's take a break. So they make a treaty. Right? And can you just show the Wikipedia thing? Mm-hmm. A definition of the Treaty of Westphalia that I found in Wikipedia. So you want to read? Read up to there.
1. The principle of the sovereignty of nation states and the fundamental right to political self-determination. The principle of legal equality between nation states. The principle of internationally binding treaties between states. Principle of non-intervention of one state in the internal affairs of another state. Mm-hmm. These ideas are crucial in the development of international relations, forming the basis for the modern system of recognized sovereignty for every independent nation state.
Okay. That bad. Mm-hmm. But if you look at, for example, right, let's look at this one and this one, which I think are, let's say, two flawed principles. Because if you're in a, I'm saying might is right. You want to bash and want to take over. That's your mentality. So if you set up a principle of legal equality between nation states, that's what you had up to a certain point. But as I'm saying, it's like, okay, we're equal. And we hate each other's guts.
We equally hate each other.
Yeah. We're going to legally stop, killing each other. But if you do one thing, I'm going to, at least equally give it back to you. Legally equally, punch your face. So, that if there's anything happening, right, one incident, the war can start again. And if you look at here, principle of non-intervention of one state in the internal affairs of another state. And, if something happens, like we saw today with Israel and Palestine, who's the first to start it? Hezbollah? Kidnapped? Or Israel, Well, they kidnap the people from Hamas, they intervene, right? So who's to say who intervened first, right? And then you get this complete bullshit about, I didn't intervene, you intervened, blah, blah, blah. So if you just say, we have a principle of non-intervention, you should also ask yourself, what does that mean between, what does it mean about the relation of those two nations? It's like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, right? My freedom starts where basically yours begin. I'm not gonna bother you. Whatever you do, it's your liberty. It's your freedom.
My freedom ends where yours begin.
Yeah. So I can do whatever I want, but if you try to stop my freedom, you're wrong. You can't do that, right? If you think about someone who's doing something wrong, if something wrong, if you don't intervene, right? Well, is this, you know, like, I had this discussion with my father, but we can get you through that. But it's this idea that at a certain point you have to intervene, right? And what happened is that the Pope, the new Pope, Urban the Eighth, I was about to say the Seventh. But Urban the Eighth was actually a pope that's not that bad. And he's got some good advisors, good people working for the Vatican. You can put that down. So he's got people like Giulio Mazzarini, called Mazarin, who was working for the Vatican. And at a certain point, Urban VIII in 1639 decides, okay, let's try to do something. Let's try to calm things down. So they organize in a city named Cologne. Or maybe you can put the map back. I don't know if it's in there though. But you see, Cologne was called a neutral,
free city?
Yeah, free city. Which I think was, I guess kind of neutral if you want. Like the Vatican today.
Cologne.
Like
yeah, there it is. You go up to where follow Mainz and then Berg. Just over from go from the H.
Yeah.
Go back towards the doorway.
Right. Cologne. Alright. So they managed to he sends three people, and the idea is it's one of those processes. You gotta find a real city where you're gonna start talking about peace. But it never occurs because there's so much suspicion, right? These guys are trying to talk, you know, with Protestant Catholics, but no one really wants to talk to each other. So, and it's you know, when people say history repeats itself, I mean, the people we're dealing with are not like super ingenious, right? Those Venetians or fascist or synarchist. The problem that they have is that they keep using the same thing, and people, because they don't learn, sometimes they just fall again for their tricks. And the best tricks that the Venetians have is always suspicion. So whoever is there, right? You got these people from the Vatican trying, let's make peace. Well, first thing that the people that would all be the certain representatives of those principalities would go there and say, well, I'm not gonna make the first steps. These guys, my enemies, should make the first step. I'm not gonna take any. No way. So there's a lot of suspicion, so no one wants to do anything. And it took up to 14. I think it's 14. 16. Yeah, 1643. We have basically the Duke of Denmark, who decides to make the first step. But then we get another problem. Because, I mean, the fact that the Duke wants to kind of help, you know, that people want to talk. But you have nations like France, who are not part of the Holy Roman Empire, where you have Poland, and you have Sweden. North Sea, so Sweden's probably there. We're not part of that, and are a pretty big nation. And the problem what happens is that Louis the 13th, dies like maybe 3 days before. So you get Louis XIV. Okay, so we know that Louis XIV is a bit insane. But in 1643, Louis XIV is 5 years old. It's, you know, so we can't do much. But there's Louis XIII's wife, who's the queen of Austria, Anne of Austria, who's a person that was basically convinced by the Pope, people like Mazarin, that this has to be done, that the treaty with Spain had to occur. And what happens is that Mazarin becomes the prime minister of France. So he'll be the one dealing not with just with the treaty. And that's very important because there's other things that's going to blow some hippie's mind about how we make peace. You know? Remember I met a guy from Greenpeace once and we had like this table about the Iraq war. And he says, every time I make a subscription, I give a hug. Stop the war in Iraq. So that's forbidden in the Treaty of Westphalia. Don't get, right? I mean, we're gonna read what the Treaty of Westphalia means, but if you just remember what was being said there, don't think about some type of romantic generosity. Or just, some type of, like a romantic idea that, basically that there's no rigor in your idea of bringing peace. There's no scientific understanding of what peace really should be and how you can make it happen. So Mazarin is Prime Minister of France. And the first thing, of course, is, let's go through the treaty, what it really is. Out of the first two articles, there's 128 articles, which these two are the most important. The rest is mainly to appease people, to calm them down. Okay, we'll give you that type of land, we'll give you that money. I'll stop bugging you with your wife and stuff. So, but this is the key. This is the intention that's gonna guide these nations through the future up to today. And Wikipedia was not, they say it's the base for international law, which is true. But we gotta see exactly what that means. You wanna read again? If you can read.
Article 1.
Yeah.
A Christian general and permanent peace and true and honest friendship must rule between the Holy Imperial Majesty and the Holy All Christian Majesty, as well as between all and every ally and follower of the mentioned Imperial Majesty, the House of Austria, and successors, and this peace must be so honest and seriously guarded and nourished that each part furthers the advantage, honor, and benefit of the other. A faithful neighborliness should be renewed and flourish for peace and friendship and flourish again.
Okay, first we saw the idea of a non-intervention. The pure relations toward the others say, well, don't bug it. But now, right, that each part furthers advantage, honor, and benefit of the other. Because as you'll see, as I'll show, the idea of suspicion, you can suspect someone, right? Saying, yeah. But you can also suspect an idea. And we're gonna see, maybe it's a bit quick, but there's an example of a specialist in Westphalia, Father Bourgeon, a typical, university teacher. I mean, we'll see. So, Article 2.
Article 2. On both sides, all should be forgotten and forgiven. What has from the beginning of the unrest, no matter how or where, from one side or the other, happened in terms of hostility, so that neither because of that, nor for any other reason or pretext, should anyone commit or allow to happen any hostility, unfriendliness, difficulty, or obstacle in respect to persons, their status, goods, or security itself, or through others secretly or openly, directly or indirectly, under the pretense of the authority of the law, or by way of violence within the kingdom, or anywhere outside of it, and any earlier contradictory treaties, should not stand against this. Instead, the fact that each and every one, from one side and the other, both before and during the war, committed insults, violent acts, hostilities, damages and injuries, without regard of persons or outcomes, should be completely put aside, so that everything, whatever one could demand from another under his name, will be forgotten to eternity.
Forgotten to eternity, if you don't even reopen the book. It was also mentioned here that should be forever forgotten and forgiven. Okay, so at least it's a bit deeper than Wikipedia. But then the question is, how do you make that happen in a world that was led by something completely different? And you have, you have a very few people dedicated to the idea. Right? You're talking about Mazarin. You have Anne of Austria, the Pope. At a certain point, you're going to have some other people, but it's never those you think it's going to be. Right? Sometimes it's... That's like when you organize, right? You have a super good discussion with someone, that's so good, but then you call and you're like, the impotent. Right? And the ones you have the most time with are actually the ones that gotta actually do the work. And it's the same thing, because the enormous problem was that how do you get the German electorate to endorse the treaty, knowing that one of the main influence the Duke of Bavaria, was one of the best friends, and not just like chummy, they were a long time friends during their childhood. You know, Ferdinand II married the wife of the Duke, the sister of the Duke. And if you don't get the Duke of Bavaria, you don't get any treaty. It's not going to happen. You can wait until they die, but you know, we can wait until George Bush ends his term.
Ferdinand II is friends with Duke of Bavaria, mm-hmm. and Mazarin and Anne are trying to get the Duke of Bavaria to be in the treaty, but he's not in. The first Ferdinand is not going to accept the treaty.
No, because it's a question of there's a war going on. Ferdinand II is not a peaceful person. And if you have the Duke of Bavaria, one of the most influential person in this whole process, that, you know, you gotta get him with you so that you can change the whole dynamic in that region. Alright. Maybe we can put the map. And then, I'll get to that. I mean, there's a lot to cover, right? Schiller wrote extensively about that. He wrote a trilogy, a drama, the Wallenstein trilogy. He wrote the History of the 30 Years' War. So we're not gonna go through all that stuff. We're gonna try to look it up from a pedagogical standpoint. And try to have a sense of what happened at that time, because it's kind of a challenge to try to measure how things are going, right? A lot of people after the ceasefire in Lebanon says, "All right, over, done. We're gonna send the UN and But the problem and what LaRouche mentioned is that no, you gotta push and push now for a peace treaty. The more you wait, the more you're going to have something coming up to restart the whole thing. And that's when, you see, we had a lot of people that took as a good news the fact that Olmert, the Prime Minister of Israel and his Defense Minister, lost an enormous 30% popularity in Israel. You know, which could have been a good thing, because we know some people were against the war. But then what you have is that you have a reaction, a synarchist reaction to this. And what you see, what's an example, but you had a letter written by Israeli reservists against Olmert. They made a declaration, but what did they say? Did they say, we don't like wars, we like Palestine, stop the war? No, they say, look, buddy, we don't have any means. Give us guns, give us bulletproof jackets, give us tanks, and we'll kick these guys out. So then you have a push to basically replace Olmert by something even crazier. Right? And then we talk about Benjamin Netanyahu, who had met Cheney before the war, who has a past of being someone you don't want to hang around. Like, one of the person that actually helped destroy the Oslo Accord, which was what was generated through the Madrid conference in the 80s, I think 85. Is that the first Madrid conference?
91.
Yeah, because you had George Bush the father, and James Baker, one of these people. Can you just give me some Vasa? Some beer. All right. Okay, so let's get the Duke of Bavaria, and that's going to go easier. But the problem is that you need a lot of people, and I mean, and the friend, Mazarin basically showed his colors at the beginning, and he asked the king to endorse two letters. I'm going to go through a little bit these two letters. They were basically written in order to get people involved. Where are these letters again? Okay, page 14, that's here. Okay. Okay, I'll read. That's the first letter that was sent in 1644. It was basically written by the two French, it's called plenipotentiaries, basically the representative. And also that, you know, it's important to know that. It's a pretty funny anecdote, but the Treaty of Westphalia was signed by, Catholic and Protestant. But they were in two different cities. They wouldn't meet. Yeah. So you had the French and the Catholics on one side, and you had the Swedes and the Protestants. I'll give you the name of the city. Munster. Yeah, Munster is the Catholics.
Munster. And where's that?
The green area.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And the other one, which is Osenbruck, but it wasn't. They say it's 30 kilometers around.
That's Protestant or Catholic?
That's Catholic. What's green? Catholic?
Oh, okay.
So it must be maybe, in the ground area.
Oh.
Right, so you gotta sign a treaty about the advantage of the other, but the two groups don't. And then, because there's a lot of suspicion, you say, well, okay, I can send a representative, but you're gonna shoot him, right? No, we'll keep on friendly turf.
What is Hussite?
Hey, did people say why Bohemia ran?
Protestant. Oh, sorry, no, it's Hussite. Hussite. Might be
It was like kind of Calvinist like.
Could be.
It was a more extreme sect.
Could be. Alright, so yeah, the letters. Okay.
Sorry, can I ask what the hanging
Sorry?
The striped red and white
this?
Yeah.
Think that's
Moravia?
I just think that's combined area. It's all throughout the, if you look at this map, it's all throughout the green and the orange as well.
Oh.
But it looks like it could be just like...
this is divided among, you have the brown line, which divides certain areas, but then you have the religion.
Oh, I just trying to show you, the stripe is there.
Yeah, well, maybe I didn't did a good map. I don't think it's pretty old, but I guess it doesn't change like in 100 years like that. All right.
Fuck. I missed it.
Where's Bougin? Okay, yeah, Bougin.
Yeah. So I'll basically go through the two letters. The two letters were written at different times to make sure you could get a lot more people involved, because you just... Principal was not popular. Since the other wasn't cool. So.
Who wrote these letters?
They were written by Comte d'Avaux, Count of Avaux, and Abel Servia, who wrote that to all the German principalities, to invite them, you know, to negotiate. But it was that the one? No, the second letter was signed by the king. 5-year-old guy, or was 7 at the time. Several years of delay brought about by the House of Austria and her allies, and since the French plenipotentiaries traveled to Munster, filled with the hope of a soon to be established peace, we were stunned to see that no deputies had been delegated, neither from the Electoral College, the princes, or the state, nor from the particular states that compose the empire. Right, so no one. It was nonetheless in favor of German liberty that France and Sweden had taken up arms, both of them having resolved to leave the territory of those states only after having reestablished all of the states of the empire in their own rights. Right? However, if the allies of the House of Austria attempted to persuade him, the emperor, that this invitation was merely a pretext that the two allied crowns were attempting to use in order to lure them into their own particular advantages, it would be easy for those princes and representatives of those states to judge by themselves simply by coming to Munster and witness everything that would be going on. They would also discover that no general and lasting peace were possible unless it were concerned with all of the states of the empire. And since war and peace are not things that concern only the emperor, France also has too much self-interest. For the sake of her own security in promoting German liberty and to never consent in letting it be oppressed. The fact is that this was the primary motivation for the war, especially the fact that the House of Austria had for a long time been accused of aspiring to become the monarchy of all of Europe and seemed intent on establishing her center in Germany, on the ruins of German freedom. It is in that spirit that so many rights had been abolished, that laws had been violated, that magistrates had been despoiled, that princes and electors had been banned by the empire. Still to this day, at the Diet of Frankfurt, the emperor has no other view than to become the master of the Articles of Peace. And if the state did not oppose him, that would be the end of their liberties. However, since the most favorable opportunity has arisen to remedy these abuses, the time has now come for you to send your deputies to Munster and to Osnabrück. It was with that intention in mind that France states that if you were to let such precious moments flee, you would find yourself into trouble when, after the peace had been achieved throughout Europe, you were to discover that your tranquility depended solely on the sovereign goodwill of the emperor and even of the kings of Spain. For example, the Peace of Prague, which had been settled without your participation, had only become the seed of new troubles, which would have been avoided if you had been consulted. Finally, your honor and your interest equally demand that you be present in Munster, because in an alternate assembly, you would be playing a very mediocre part in the ratification of the treaty, and you would never be very well informed of what really happened in Munster and in Osnabrück. Furthermore, the emperor would very easily become master of the proceeding, over which you would have no control, and communication from one place to another could not be done properly and would cause the negotiation to linger uninterminably because of the great distances involved. So, you know, so you have a first letter trying to kind of appease
doubts. No, it's not against you. It'll just come and see. And you see where it's in goodwill, you know. Everything is going to be fine. But that's at that point then that you got to think of, you know, it's always easy to talk about a principle. You can talk about, whether you want to develop a nation or whether you're talking about, you know, being a moral person, being a political person, right? I'm political. I follow everything. I read newspapers. Yeah, but what do? Like, are you really the person that you say you are? I care about the world. All those children in Ethiopia. Praise my heart. But what is it that you do? Right? And the same thing for Mazarin. He said, okay. I can try to appease them the whole time, but I mean, I gotta do something. I gotta show that I care really for these people. Alright. So let's get to the second. Page 21. Oh, come on. Just want to find it back. Schiller. Oh, yes. It's page 21, but... Okay, now that's there. Just smaller. Okay, but just before we get into that, because we gotta, as I was saying before, right? If you have a constant war, it's always going. While people are discussing, well, and that means also friends, right? Actually, the friends and the Swedes are actually allied in a war I'm gonna go into. If you're in a war and talking about the advantage of the other, do you stop the war? Do you stop intervening in other people's affairs, if you want? Do you stop taking territories? And that's the funny thing with France and the Swedes, because they actually kept invading. You say, well, this doesn't work. But then, Mazarin explains in different letters why waging war is actually what's going to bring him to peace. And he said, come on, man. Just love, man. Why do you make war? No? Well, I don't really need to read it. It's very short. But the thing is that you have France, which is invading with the Swedes. Can you put the map back?
Yep.
Which is, yeah, that's the problem. They're invading Bavaria. But they need the Duke of Bavaria to be for the peace of Westphalia. So, man. You have the map?
Yeah, it's coming. All the things happening.
Right, so let's try to have this guy on our side by basically invading him. And there's a series of letters that Mazarin will write to the general in charge over there. It's called Henri de Turenne, who later become the traitor But Mazarin is very specific. He says, okay, you're going to invade Bavaria, but, you know, don't go too far. You're not there to crush anyone. You're there to win. You're there to win battles. But you don't push people up to the extreme. Right? Because, and I forget where, what was that I said? Forget, maybe it wasn't that. The problem that you have in irregular warfare, what you have is that if you, okay, Bavaria. Okay, right there, France.
How did you get to Bavaria?
Well, because you have the Duke of Bavaria, they want to get on their side.
How did they get there?
How did they get there? Yeah, but they just bring their troops.
Does that mean all these guys were alive with them or something?
Of course.
The what?
Were all these guys in the middle alive with them or something?
All the green.
Who's attacking Bavaria?
The French and the Swedes.
But what he's asking is, how did the French cross the green area to go and attack Bavaria? Did the people in between ally with French and Swedes? Because the Swedes are all in north.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that, all here.
I couldn't tell you.
The French are mostly Catholic. The green is.
Oh, yeah, true. So if you have Catholics, right?
This map changed over time.
Yeah, yeah, as well. But,
just one I mean, if you want to go to Bavaria, it's all.
I couldn't tell you all the details about the war. So yes, you have these letters to Henri de Turenne, telling you to not go too far because, as I was saying, in the irregular warfare, what you have, like what you have in Iraq, for example, you have people that are basically paid. Their income comes from war. The more you have wars, basically, the better it is. So you have these kind of mercenaries that's gonna. Just loot the whole place, destroy, you know, and just take over, right? But that's also from that standpoint that most of the time a war that could have been stopped is going to be actually started again because the person that's been so crushed by tyranny, by oppression, will actually do whatever it takes, like what we see in Palestine. Keep that there. Crush them, but see, there's always something coming back. Keep they crush them, but there's always something coming back, right? And because the only one that can really make peace, just got bashed, right? What can you expect from Germany that was completely this area was completely destroyed, right? How can they really, right? How can they really, like, they could be thinking about the advantage of the other, but they just have nothing. Like, what can you ask to Palestine to do for Israel? You know, they might have some olive oil. They have, say, hey, we can give you our poverty. So actually the winner of these battles of the war is actually the one that will have to take the first step in order to implement the peace. And this is a bit of the sense of what's happening because the more that the French army is getting through and the more that the discussions are going in these two towns because, you know, there's a certain the news going about those debates and about what the French are trying to do. What happens is that the French army actually, after having a few fights, finds itself pretty welcomed by the Germans, by the people from Bavaria or the other cities around. They say, okay, you guys are here to make peace. I mean, you gotta think, these people don't have much. They were destroyed by a long process that were identified in the letter, right? And to set up this Germany as a kind of a new turf for the Austrian Emperor. And at a certain point, yeah, you're going to have Germans going to rally the French army. And the more it goes, actually, the more Mazarin is going to pull support for his proposal, despite the fact that the Duke of Bavaria, I mean, he's still the Duke of Bavaria, still a good friend of Ferdinand II. And the problem is this, and I think we're gonna just go back, but I'm gonna give you a sense of because people have to think of the way what we're in right now in terms of political fight. There's as much suspicion today as there was at the time. And by using this guy, Father Bougeon, he's giving a quote about Mazarin's intention. And you're talking about a book written in 1764. So, 100 and almost 20 years after. Right? Where the guy, I mean, I'll read it, and I'll read this part and the second part. It says this. It was also with this motivation that the plenipotentiaries were ordered to begin that's the plenipotentiaries of France. Right? The plenipotentiaries were ordered to begin the negotiations with the interest of the Allies in mind, right? Advantage of the other, in order to tie them more and more to France by this proof of zeal and to deter any suspicion that might arise through some infidelity on their part, if they were to decide to begin by promoting their own interest. To this first mean, Mazarin proposed a second one, which was to be no less effective. It was to bring into his own views, that is, to the interest of France, even the allies of the emperor, as in the case of the Duke of Bavaria and other princes and states of the empire who supported the party of Ferdinand. And since the perspective of their own self-interest was the only thing that could bring to fruition the success of this project, Mazarin wanted to make them believe, as if that were to be at all possible, that France was completely disinterested in this war, only had an army to defend them, and only had their liberty and security at heart. At least he flattered himself in convincing them, which was true, that if France could obtain the satisfaction she was attempting to get with this peace treaty, they would themselves benefit greatly from it, not only because France would have forced the emperor to restitute to the nation of Germany its ancient freedom and all of its rights, but because once she were well established in the neighborhood of Germany, she would be able to help the princes and the states against any attempt of oppression on the part of the emperor. Mazarin, most of all, wanted to get the Duke of Bavaria to realize that by favoring the demands of France, he would be working for his own benefit, since this was the most infallible means of guaranteeing his control over the High Palatinate and of acquiring the dignity of the elector. Right? Mazarin tried to make them believe, right, he's be caring about them. And the second sentence is, second paragraph. In fact, since the success of this enterprise required a profound secret, nothing was more highly recommended to the plenipotentiaries, and they executed their orders so well that it was never possible for the mediators, nor for the enemies, not even for the friends of France, to ever penetrate the depths of this mystery that was hidden in the policy of Cardinal Mazarin. So, you know, to talk about suspicion, like 120 years after, There had to be a secret intention. No one figured that out yet, but there had to be. It's impossible. You can't just think about the other. So you got to deal with this, plus, you know, wars and this idea of, you know, of goodwill. Who's going to show basically some goodwill? And the letters of France managed to have some impact. And the second, because France managed to finally give out some of his own advantage, managed to rally some people to their side. It's very short. That'll be my last quote. Yeah. Okay. That's September 4th. So I think it's a few months after the other one. The letter says, "We have already extended the olive branch and have even accepted inequitable conditions that were proposed to us. And we have also even abandoned some of our rights and some rights of our allies as well, because it was purely out of kindness to the king, purely out of love for peace, to which he decided to sacrifice all of the rights which were his by virtue of the preliminary treaty. Because the king gave us the power to accept all of their demands, and we are disposed to do that, what could be holding you back from this moment forward? Let us get together, each on his side. Let us choose the formulas, the clauses, the precautions, the terms that you wish, even to the point of completely exhausting the mediators. Let us eliminate anything that might cause umbrage to the most defiant mind. We shall consent to everything, providing that our adversaries agree in advance to negotiate in good faith." So from that point on, then you had a certain, open up of the minds, and certain actions were done towards, the signature, which occurred 4 years later, October 24th. And finally what happened is that the Duke of Bavaria was basically left alone in his, was left for his, of his castle, decided to go with the agreement. And that's one of those paradoxes that a lot of these kings have to face. He says, well, if I don't basically go with France, then there's nowhere I'll go after that. I could stick with Ferdinand II, but this guy is going to ravage the whole place. And the Duke, who's like 73, he signs a treaty, which is a contract, which is pretty nice, where he puts himself under the protection of France, right? And says, well, a bit like what we saw in Rabelais, we have Alfred Ball that basically want to give everything he has, where the Duke of Bavaria will propose to France, territories, money, etc. But of course, one of the things that helped that Ferdinand II actually had died, and he was replaced by Ferdinand III, which was not as evil, but didn't have any, basically, as a strong link with the Duke of Bavaria. But, what happens after those type of treaties?
You have to carry them out.
What's that?
You have to carry them out.
We have a contract, man. It says it all. What happens if... what was Mazarin's situation the whole time? Right? Might is right. Venetians. Agents. Control. And then the guy gets there and says, okay, I know, advantage of the other guys, come on. And then he starts organizing the population. Not quite, but mainly the principal, different principalities, the electorate, the dukes, the nobility, in order to make that happen. And if you think, like when our enemy looks at us, and they're pretty freaking out because they see us advancing, so they gotta do something. Stop these people. So you can imagine that Mazarin had a little pressure here. Someone wanna kill him or something? Right? And the thing is that, right, the people today would see Mazarin as, oh, well, leader, this guy's good. But at the time what happened is that 2 years later there was a development of a movement in France called La Fronde. F-R-O-N-D-E. It was basically promoted to we're going to stop the development of France, we're going to bring back, might is right.
What was that called?
Fronde. F-R-O-N-D-E.
Fronde is like a slingshot. Like a...
Like David and Goliath?
Yeah, David and Goliath. Stone that they're going to kill.
Yeah, and so at that time Mazarin managed to put in jail. He's still the prime minister. The king is still too young. That's like 1850. So he managed to put like three of the main guys from La Fronde in jail.
1850 or
1650. And so he puts three of those guys in jail. So the enemy reacts. And a year and 2 months after, Mazarin, through a coup in the parliament, gets exiled. That friend. So, you know, a bit of a problem there. But he keeps going though. Because don't forget, you still have the Regente de France, Queen of Austria, still there. So then there's a process of Mazarin trying to educate the Queen on who the real enemy of France are. For a number of months. And then what happened is that, the Queen decides to put Louis XIV on the throne, being judged as mature enough. But, she says, he still needs a tutor. She managed from her own approach to make some type of coup to bring back Mazarin as the advisor of Louis XIV. But, Louis XIV is not a nice person. And not only did he have Mazarin as an advisor for 10 years, he's going to also get Jean-Baptiste Colbert, like 20 years.
Whoa.
Right? Like the top people, you know. Like, you know, physical economy comes from people like Colbert. And, you know, we went through that the other time, the other day, about what Colbert represents. And despite that, the guy managed to he creates a lot of wars, right? I'm just trying to find a quote. Our friend Miquetel. It should be at the end.
Alright, yeah, it's fine. Who is that? Go ahead.
Well, you were there.
Was it there?
Yeah, it was a, when people talk about, the idea of Colbertism was like the first idea of having, like a nation that would finance through credit, through different means, through the treasury of the king, would finance infrastructure projects. There were different projects of canals that were done by him. But he also created what's called the Revenge of the Cradle. It was when France went from 7 million to 20 million inhabitants.
Revenge of the Cradle.
Through basically the development of France's economy.
That was like reference, like...
After the plague?
Are we talking like way after that?
Yes, it's after the treaty, so it's 1670-something. He dies in 1682. Financing, basically financing procreation, but making sure that you're going to have an economy sustaining that. And you had like different type of science projects that were there, like building ships. And there was this famous example where they had these enormous ships to bring some freight, which would usually take months to build. And you had a contest, I think, in Marseille. He had a contest in France, and the contest was won by Marseille, which was to build the boat in the fastest time. And it took them 7 hours. Seven?
Around that.
Yeah, around a few hours instead of a few months.
Wow.
You can imagine.
Wow. Okay, and last question. When you said he was in the business of finance and infrastructure, was he affiliated with the banking system at that point? Or was it some sort of...
Was
it an official bank?
The king? No, the king? He had the king and he had a minister of finance. Colbert replaced the former minister of finance that was crazy and managed to put the fortune of the king not too much into wars, but more into development. Anyway, forget the quote. But as I'm saying, you know, you have a... If you have a tree like that, which is based on one of those very... based on a universal principle, something that 300 years later, we've seen the advantage of that principle. Like, there was an example that just popped out in my head when I was sitting there, but when you think about Franklin Roosevelt, and just think about his behavior towards Japan, could have bombed the whole place. Could have said, okay, this is Roosevelt City. Rooseveltopolis or something. Right? But he didn't do that. He just, okay, we're gonna wait. We're gonna encircle them and we're gonna go bash them. Because actually we want them as our allies. And then after that he had a discussion, he had Americans that went there was around the Japanese constitution, I think. Just to make sure you had the proper development in Japan. But at the time, the problem is that it's not even obvious there was a change. Because there's still wars. And Masahei is not a superhero. Right? Mm-hmm. The other, whatever. You get lost. Right? So, and, you know, what will happen today? Are people, how many people will tell you nothing has changed? Right? Oh, you guys are organizing. But where is the change? It's still wars. It's the economy collapse. Who's been organizing for 30 years? Right? And if you look at what he did around the Middle East, which is pretty impressive, but already in 75, Roosh was in Iraq to talk with Arab leaders, to talk about not just the Middle East per se, but to talk about his proposal for an international development bank. Right? It's a bit of a bank like what you had after the Bretton Woods accord, Bretton Woods deal. And, you know, from 75 up to today, right? We have a list of things that we can go through, but what are the different projects that were proposed? Also different meanings with, you know, with both sides. In 78, it says here, Roosh holds several meetings with World Jewish Congress President Nahum Goldman on his economic proposals in the Middle East. Right? And today you have this proposal by Yossi Bailin, which is a fair proposal. But as long as people just wait for some type of a firework, right? Like water, sounding water, Palestinians becoming, you know, suddenly filthy rich or like opulent, it's not gonna happen like that. It's an enormous process where people don't start realizing in which world they're in right now. And what it actually takes to get nations out of their mess, they're going to get depressed pretty quickly, right? But the idea is how do we develop a passion like people like Mazarin had, you know? I mean, you're talking about since 1639 to 1648, like a 9-year process, and for like half of the time, no one wants to give a crap. Right? And how many people during the last 30 years said no to LaRouche? You're crazy, you're nuts, not gonna work. But then you have LaRouche that keeps pushing. And you get to a point where those ideas
have to be implemented.
But if there's no leadership, if there's no a group of people that have a certain understanding of what it's going to take to implement that, it's not going to occur. And I would say, I mean, then you got to think in terms of LaRouche's standpoint when he looks at the LaRouche youth movement, right? I mean, LaRouche, you talk about what we do here, he's very optimistic. They say, LaRouche, we're like 15. You want us to take over Canada? What are you talking about? Right? You want to go to BC? So far? No? we're like just a bunch of kids. And you say you're confident in what we do? Why do you recruit youth? You recruit like generals, recruit like politicians. Youth? You gotta educate them? It takes years. And people will see that, right? And when you look at some of our organizers, you see, if you look at them through the years, because I've been around for 5 years, so I've seen a lot of people, so, you know, just being not pathetic, but not, you know.
Close to.
And you want to, sometimes you want to say, look, please help us out, leave, you know. But the person actually. Well, it goes back to this question of measurement, right? Just as much as you measure a political situation, right? If you try to see what's going on during the Treaty of Westphalia, and see if there's no change. But same thing when you're working with people. I mean, there's a certain process of it's like a fight going on, right? And it's like Mazarin. In order to get peace, you gotta sometimes wage a war. Wage a war against stupidity and sophistry and, you know, a lot of crap like that. Because sophistry is today, I think, our the common enemy of humanity. People sometimes will refer to sophistry in a light way. And they actually forget that sophistry is the cause of the destruction of civilizations. Not just that people will say stupid things, but actually a spread of sophistry can annihilate societies. Right? And so we have to fight a lot of that. And LaRouche was pretty clear in his latest paper, one of his latest paper about the priesthood of the new priesthood of Babylon, where we'll have to deal with all sorts of things. But people coming out of universities that supposedly are elite, you know, the doctor sees thesis approved by the priesthood, you know, peer review committee, who are actually professional sophists. Not that they're mean, but they were brainwashed towards sophistry. So that's what we're facing. And I think, see, during this week, what we want to do, so we had some help, have an ongoing collaboration with people from Boston. We're here for a few days. Now we're going to go down to the Cadre School in Boston, occurring this weekend, which will be followed by a week of action in the capital of the United States, Washington, which will occur during LaRouche's speech on September 6th. But also, we're planning to send people in Quebec City in order to intervene on the New Democratic Party convention.
When is that again?
I think it's the 7th or the 8th.
The
8th, 9th. 8th,
9th. It's in Quebec City for the whole Canada?
Yeah. Like CW? The whole CW was in Vancouver. And also we're planning, as I think Aaron mentioned, we're planning to go back to Winnipeg. And if we're rational, knowing our the number of people we have, I mean, we just have to be everywhere. We just have to have LaRouche's all over the place. So knowing what has to be done, we need to recruit a lot of people that will fight for the same principles that Mazarin or LaRouche have been fighting for all those years. That's if you have any questions.
Can you tell me about how Helgeverster, in an article in the Lost EIR with Wallenstein?
Mm-hmm.
How innocent is that developing?
How what?
Because Wallenstein was in the Ferdinand's army, and he was trying to recruit the King of Sweden to fight with him against his own emperor. Right, he was trying to. How does that play into what you went into tonight? Because I know that Wallenstein was actually like murdered for political prosecution 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's. I didn't go into it too much because when I saw the I was reading, you know, this article, and then I saw this one about Wallenstein by Helga, which I've read, but I said, it's just going to be too much. But you have a tragic individual that was depicted as, you know, being a military general, you know, slaughtering people and having this like a megalomaniac intention of becoming the real emperor. Right? He had such a support by the population. He was known to be able to raise an army in a day.
Right? No, I gave you money.
Well, if you have support, see, if you have popularity, you say, come fight with me, people will say, oh, shit, let's go. He had a lot of money for sure.
Mm-hmm.
He had his own fortune, which always helps. But what Schiller discovers through his own study is that actually Wallenstein had a certain idea of what nation-state means. But for different reasons chose not to go in that path. So I haven't much details, but that's something I want to read,
mm-hmm.
this trilogy.
Yeah. That's the Wallenstein thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But see, you're dealing with, you know, like one of his main failure was that, you know, one of the things that really hurt him is that he had raised an army that was too big. So his army was so big he couldn't sustain it.
Yeah.
And then he had, you know, plague, disease, horses dying, feed the horses, and then they had to fight out of despair.
That's fine.
No, we're gonna all die anyway. So they went to this fight and they got their ass kicked. That's, can't say much about that now. I'll give another class.
As an example with that, like, the type of, just what led into this, the type of warfare that was going on to actually get France and Sweden to work together, was, in a sense, Wallenstein's offering to the King of Sweden, come fight with me, you know, to beat the Empire, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We put our armies together, and he's like, well, you know, that's a bit dodgy.
Mm-hmm.
You want me to fight with you against your Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the ways that he did it, one of the ways he tries to trick or kind of force the King of Sweden to do it, is that they're in a position where in which the King of Sweden, I can't remember which place they're in, they went up and set it up in this town, and the King of Sweden knew that Wallenstein's army was coming. So they had to make a decision, are we going to go for open warfare, or are we just going to, like, camp and come
mm-hmm.
for encirclement? So they started to camp.
Yeah.
And then what happened is that Wallenstein ended up trying to, like, starve
yeah.
The King of Sweden's army, so then he was forced to have to regroup.
Mm-hmm.
Because just in terms of the ways in which he was going about it, because what Schiller actually develops is the idea of the benevolent dictator.
Mm-hmm.
Wallenstein, in a sense, had an idea of what needed to be done, but look, he had to be the one to do it, you know what I mean? He let greed and ambition, kind of like Hillary Clinton, sort of get in the way of what was really needed.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you think about the Middle East today, and look, Israel is like the leading nation in terms of water desalination technologies. Right? They desalinate like hell. So, I mean, in order to have peace, they'll have to give the type of technology to develop a cooperation with the Palestinians. Right? It's obvious. Right? So the leaders are over there talking about development, passing the state, stuff like that. I mean, they have to deal with a lot of shit. But they also have to deal with their own shit. Their own idea of mistrust, their own idea of economic cooperation, their own idea of, you know, you don't want to have a free trade system between the Middle East, right? You don't want to have this idea of cheap labor. But a lot of these guys, despite the fact they want to do good, like a lot of people that have been shattered by the way economics is being approached in school or in society in general, say, so you gotta go up to that. Free trade is there to stay. I like everyone. I like, you know, I want to help the Palestinians, but they gotta go through, you know, free trade, or they gotta go through the usual development of, you know, promoted by the UN at a certain point. Said you have, you gotta go gradually. Start with low windmills. We'll make sure you start like very low, so we'll bring you cheap windmills, right? Then gradually go from coal. You know, we don't want to rush you too much. So in 70 years, you'll have nuclear energy.
Initiation process.
Huh?
Initiation process.
Yeah. Right? So you don't want to have that. If Einstein is just more tragic, though, you could have changed the whole thing.
I was just going to parallel him with the type of characters that we have playing out today. Like, Lurish mentioned the fact that even though, like, the Senate and the Democrats are seeming pretty corrupt, they are actually patriotic, because you can't judge patriotism as one issue. The fact is that we're in a position where in which that we can organize these guys. The same way which Bolenstein did when organized the people who's confronted with the youth movement to embark on the streets.
Maybe that was the problem.
How long did the treaty actually last?
That was
so good today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Even if you look at the famous Treaty of Paris that Lerouche keeps referring to, it talks about the Treaty of Westphalia.
1763.
So it was always good. Still is good.
A big event. It had like a.
Oh, you mean like the moment?
Yeah, it's been under attack. I remember last year.
Yeah, it's under attack today.
People who think the era of Westphalia is over, it's finished.
Well, yeah, it's under attack in different ways. One, they'll say, it's time for terrorism. It's like in the Republic. They say you have justice. You have Trismegistus, who's completely crazy, right? Might is right, and the leader is always right, stuff like that. But then you have the more insinuous idea of justice, right? That's being elaborated by the two other guys, which is more like, you know, people want to do good, but because they can't harm people, so we gotta have this type of deal, kind of accommodate the poor, the small people. But the same thing with the Treaty of Westphalia, you have different attacks that are, like, made by Wikipedia, for example, that will completely dilute the real importance of those treaties. I think that's more of a danger than. Like Kissinger, Blair, who listens to them? But who listens to university teachers? So yeah, Treaty of Westphalia is good, but it depends on the interpretation. So, I mean, again, it goes back to sophistry.